Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
Hey guys!
Hi!
Check out Rec Level 3.
What's that?
We're a gaming, geek, nerd culture fandom podcast.
Ooh. Wow!
And you can find us every Friday at 11:30 a.m. on reclevel3.com.
Yay!
The Monster Sci-Fi Show presents Versus. Hi everyone. I am the Monster, and your host for this podcast called Versus. So, what is this show all about? The premise is to talk about and compare the original movie or work versus the remade or updated version. Does the original movie still work today? Does the remake outshine the original? I'll compare the directors, the actors, the stories, and the music. Which movie will reign supreme? On today's podcast, since Kong Skull Island is coming out, this first Versus podcast will be a triple header. I will be talking about the original King Kong 1933 movie versus the 1976 remake, as well as the 2005 version. So, what this podcast will not be talking about? I will not be talking about Mighty Kong. I will not be talking about Kong the Animated Series. In fact, I will not be talking about Kong King of Atlantis. What the hell is that? Or Queen Kong. Or King Kong's Adventure in Heavenly Palace. Tarzan and King Kong. Kong Island. King Kong Lives. King Kong Escapes. Son of Kong. King Kong vs. Godzilla. And more importantly, I will not be talking about how King Kong went to Hong Kong to play ping pong with his ding dong. That's what this Versus is not about. It's just about Kong. That's all. So let's get started.
The stuff for which movies were made. Adventure to make you wonder if it's true while your eyes convince you that it is. Truly, the thrill of thrills. Don't miss it this time.
Let's begin by looking at the directors of King Kong. Yes, plural. There were two directors for King Kong. We had Ernest B. Schoetzack and Marin C. Cooper. Ernest took care of focusing all the scenes dealing with the human actors, whereas Marin took care of all the special effects. Now, wasn't going to mention this because they were actual sequels. We had Son of Kong and Mighty Joe Young, which Ernest did direct, and Marin went to produce both of those movies. Now, the idea came to Marin basically due to a friend that he had with the American Museum of Natural History. And there was a story behind these Komodo dragons that were being brought from Indonesia to the Bronx Zoo. Now, he liked the idea about the animals representing the primitive spirits, but what had happened is that the dragons got sick and they died. And then Cooper went on to write something to the fact that civilization had killed them. So this is where he has the idea of having the ending for King Kong, which it does prove the point that we as a civilization are kind of messed up. We don't take care of the things that are around us. This is why we can't have nice gorillas or apes that big. So the other thing to note was that towards the end of the climax, and of course, spoiler alert, he's on the Empire State Building, gets shot down. But it's actually the two directors, Ernest and Marin, that are in the plane that actually shoot down King Kong. Which is kind of a weird take on things since, you know, how the story all plays out. But if you didn't know that, well, you get a piece of information that it's new to you. So, there's not much I would say about their direction other than they prove their point about the cruelty of man infringing on the rights of animals. So, even though it is a fantasy story, it does speak to me about how much I really hated the animals being killed. And cheered when any time people died, when the animals got their revenge. So, I was, again, I'm on a mixed boat on that, so. Alright, so let's move on to the actors. And again, I'm going to focus on just four actors. We have Fay Wray, who played Ann Darrow. We have Robert Armstrong, who played Carl Denham. Bruce Cabot as Jack Driscoll. And King Kong himself. Alright, so right off the bat, Fay Wray is stunning to look at when she's not in peril. The early test screen that Carl Denham did on the ship truly was breathtaking, especially when she looked directly into the camera. It's mesmerizing, very mesmerizing. For the most part, after Anne is captured by Kong, all she basically does is try to escape and does a lot more screaming, and there's really not much more for Anne to do. This relationship, if you want to call it, with Kong is very one-sided. He's very enamored with her, but she just wants to get away despite the fact that he is protecting her constantly. Now, let's move over to Robert's performance. He's a fine performer. I've grown to really hate Carl more and more each time I watch him. Again, the moment that kills me, this is on Skull Island, in which Carl and several of the ship's men are going after Anne. And along the way, they encounter a Stegosaurus, which, you know, they throw a gas bomb to kind of knock it out, and then they wind up shooting it to death. And what kills me is just like, you know, Jack is asking, what do you call this thing? Why, it's something from the dinosaur family. Dinosaur, eh? Yes, a prehistoric beast. Just look at the length of that brute. If I only could bring back one of these alive. Yeah. And yet, when he captures Kong, he brings him back to the States alive, and he escapes, and ultimately, he gets killed. And then he blames 'tis beauty that killed the beast. No, Carl. You killed him. You are part of society's problem. Why? Kong is dead. So, screw you. Alright, so let's go to Bruce Cabot as Jack Driscoll. He's very much a macho man, but not on the level of like the Village People macho man, if you get my drift. He's very disparaging towards Anne. As he points out, there's like basically there's no need for a woman to be on the ship, and you're always in the way. And yet, during that test screen where she screams out, it's Jack that grabs the captain's arm as a, why are you scared? Why are you so jumpy? So this hardened man's man, if you want to call it that, is reacting like, I don't want to say, you know, anything bad, but acting like a woman. You know, he's grabbing for someone to reassure him that he's okay. So I find that kind of weird. But then, you know, as hard as he was to Anne, and like within the first 20 minutes, he makes this quick change, and it's like, oh, I think I love you. And expects her to kind of like, wait a minute, you're telling me all this time, you know, you treat me like crap, and then you want me to always like accept your love? That doesn't really make sense. But in any case, it's a weird moment that I thought, I didn't really care for him because it was just a very brutish kind of man, not very forward-thinking. But then again, if I compare to, I guess, the opposite side of the spectrum for the human male acting more like a brute, then Jack Driscoll is more like that, whereas Kong is more primitive but still a brute that doesn't really have a lot of thinking. He just takes what he wants, and that's exactly what I kind of saw the parallel with Jack in that sense. So let's move over to Kong himself. So despite being only 18 inches tall, he is still captivating. Despite the limited effects, the stop-motion animation is truly astounding. We have Kong fighting a T-Rex. Then he fights a snake-like creature and a pterodactyl. And it just really proves how much of a king he is on this island. There are times in which you can feel his emotion and pain. So when the example of that log rolling thing that Kong did, Jack was able to escape and on the side of the mountain, and Kong is trying to grab him, and Jack takes out his knife and stabs him in his hand, and then Kong reacts with pain, and you can see that, which I thought that's fantastic to see that kind of range of emotion. Rather than just physical action, you can actually see and almost empathize with him in that sense. And again, when he's on the Empire State Building and he's getting shot, and you can also feel that pain coming through. So it's amazing for so much details of like this to appear, that if you realize the amount of work that goes into creating each shot. Remember, each shot of frame is 24 seconds, so that has to be done 24 times within one frame. And the amount of work that goes into all this is amazing. So I was still astounded by it, and I was still impressed by it. And yes, it's very dated, but it's so impressive the amount of work if you know about stop motion animation. And Ray Harryhausen is truly a master at this craft. So, all right, so let's go into the story. Well, sort of, but I'm assuming everyone has seen King Kong. Everyone knows how this is all going to play out. Everyone knows the story. So it's really the other two movies in which I'm going to compare, because there's a lots of differences, a little nuances that you'll talk about that in the other segments. But the only thing that remains the same, spoiler alert, it doesn't end well for Kong across the board. So we'll leave it at that. And lastly, we have Max Steiner, who was the composer for King Kong. And I listened to the soundtrack, and if you actually own the copy of King Kong, and this is the more restored version, in which there's like about a 4-minute prelude right before the movie plays, you can hear a good amount of the score, and you can hear the different themes, and it really does set you up with the mindset of what to expect. And if you listen to the beginning of the main title, there's three quick beats, which is going to be Kong's theme that gets played out throughout the whole movie. So it does not get drowned out by the action. In some cases, in some movies, you are not supposed to realize the music is there. So when it's done right, it blends in together, it heightens the emotion, it really has an impact on how you're viewing the movie. And I think this movie does it all. So when you look at the visuals and you see Kong fighting, or you see Kong about to take a turn for the worse, that music really, really works well with this movie. And it does even work well separately by itself. So one of the strengths I've always said, if a movie can, movie soundtrack can play by itself and you can see the movie without watching the movie but listen to the music, that's a worthy note. So the other things that Max went on to do, and he has also done, was that he has done the soundtrack to Casablanca, The Searchers, Gone with the Wind. But more to the point, going back to The Searchers, if you have never seen that, that's a movie directed by John Ford that stars John Wayne and Jeffrey Hunter. Now, if you know Jeffrey Hunter, that's Captain Christopher Pike from Star Trek, and he was in the first pilot. So I highly, highly recommend watching The Searchers if you want to see a really good Western. That, to me, it's really fantastic. And his score is really good, and that one too. So, all right. So that's all I'm going to talk about right now for King Kong, for the 1933 version. So now I'm going to play the trailer for the 1976 King Kong and come back and start talking about the comparison to 1933.
It is 1976. The American merchant vessel Petrox Explorer has just set sail from the port of Surabaya in search of oil. What they find will shock the world.
We may be sailing into the history books.
She's alive!
You know, maybe my luck has changed.
They will discover an uncharted island that is the home of the most incredible creature on the face of the earth. A creature called Kong. Dino De Laurentiis presents the most exciting original motion picture event of all time. Kong.
No! No!
Oh! No! King Kong, a fantastic adventure.
No! No!
Open the gate!
King Kong, unlike anything you've ever experienced before. With Jeff Bridges, Charles Grodin, and introducing Jessica Lange as the beauty who charmed the beast. And starring the eighth wonder of the world, King Kong.
All right, so let's take a quick little pause here. I'm going to refer back to the trailer. If you missed it, the trailer said it was the most exciting original picture event of all time. the nerve and the gall to call itself that, considering there was another movie just happened to be called King Kong that came out in 1933. So, let's move on, shall we? The director of the original picture, John Gilliman, had this quote in which I'm going to read to you. He said, the original Kong, see, he admits it's the original, not his movie, was part of my childhood, and I loved it. I dreamed about it. What I wanted to do was recreate what I felt about it for the first time I saw it, but still adapt the story to our own day. I didn't think, and still don't, that you couldn't simply remake it. We all wanted and tried to get back to that lyrical childhood idea of Beauty and the Beast. It was tricky trying to balance all the jokes on the one hand and the danger of bathos on the other. But I wanted it to be obvious that we regarded the material with sincerity. And yet, it's original. No. So, this was not an easy set from what I've been reading. He had massive blow-ups to the point where they just waited for the blow-ups to happen before they could actually start to go to work. So things were pretty bad. He did do another movie, which I loved, which is called Death on the Nile, which is an Agatha Christie story, which I really enjoyed that book and the movie. But, you know, he's a good director. I just think his direction for doing a little bit more of a romance here, I think works a lot better than what was seen in the first movie. But again, that's just my take on things. So let's kind of put him to a side and let's look into now the actors. So we have Jessica Lange, who is the obvious Faye Ray character of Andara, but her name is Dwan. So it is kind of a play on Andara. But we'll talk about that in a moment. Charles Grodin is Fred Wilson, who is the equivalent to Robert Armstrong's performance of Carl Denham. And then we have Jeff Bridges playing Jack Prescott, which is, again, the exact same role that Bruce Cabot did as Jack Driscoll. And then Kong here, it's not 18 inches and he's not a model, but it's played by Rick Baker, and I'll talk about that in a moment. So let's start off with Jessica Lange as Dwan. This was her first starring role in which she was basically channeling her inner Marilyn Monroe. Her approach to her relationship to Kong is that she ultimately cares for him. She helps calm him down while being transported in the oil tanker. So if you remember that scene, he is really agitated and she's trying to calm him from above, but one of the knocks that he does rocks the ship and she falls through the hole, the grate, but he catches her. He puts her down, and then she was able to climb back up to safety. But again, that relationship was more on both sides. It's not as one-sided as Fay Wray is always trying to escape. She actually does care for him. And again, when we go towards the climax, where Kong is fighting off the helicopters, you know, she's saying, you know, hold me, because she knows that they won't fire on Kong, but he kind of puts her aside because, you know, he's trying to fight them off. So, but again, it's a much different character than Andara, but I thought it was okay. I looking at it now, I really didn't care for that kind of ditziness type approach, but that's what the actress was portraying, and it does kind of play out throughout the whole movie, and even towards the end, there is, I guess, a purpose to that, and a finality or a conclusion that makes sense to have that character be a certain way. So, but again, wasn't crazy about it. Then we go into Charles Grodin's performance as Fred Wilson. He is much like Carl Denham. He is, you know, unlike looking like he was looking to do a movie, he was looking to have a strike big moment with finding oil on his island. So, but the one thing that was different about him versus Carl was that he was able to turn his situation around, that the island, although it did have oil, wasn't cooked enough. So Kong, being on this island, saw an idea to market his company, that not his company, but the company he worked for, Petrox, into, at that time, a huge campaign like Exxon had with the Tiger. So, he did exactly what Carl did and exploited Kong the very exact same manner. So, nothing different with those two characters. But he is not as bad as Carl, who, again, takes out animals, whereas here, you know, he doesn't really take out animals. He just is more self-centered about his ends and his means to get what he wants out of this whole expedition. So if people die, oh well, stuff happens, but it's not on him. Moving on to Jeff Bridges, who plays Jack Prescott, is the voice of reason throughout this whole movie. And unlike his counterpart in the first movie, Jack Driscoll, he is a lot more sensitive. I hate to use the word. But at that time, it was kind of unheard of for a man to be reading, to take a woman's side, or to treat women better than what Jack Driscoll used to do. And I'm not saying that, you know, he was a bad guy, but as times change, so do men's ideals or attitudes towards women had changed. So, and again, he was more of an animal protector. He studied primates. So he was a smart man. He was a photographer. And he was in love with Dwan. So, and in this case, unlike Jack Driscoll and Anne in the first movie, this plays better between both of them, because you can see there is some romance and there's interest on both parts. But ultimately, as we get into the ending, and I'll talk about that later, things don't work out necessarily for either one of them because of what had happened. So let's move on to Kong. And if you've seen the movie, there's no hiding the fact that it was a man in an ape suit. But you may or may not know that this was played by Rick Baker, who is an accomplished Oscar-winning makeup artist. So he did work on the makeup or the prosthetics for the headpiece. So he got to play Kong, and he wore the contact lenses to make his eyes look more like gorilla eyes. And, you know, as much as there are times you just cringe at watching the performance, it is a different version of how to portray a great character like Kong, where it was a little 18-inch model. Now you have an actual person inside a costume. It's no different from what we've seen with Godzilla, and they play with miniatures and or forced perspectives or whatever. So that's just another approach. Did it work? No. But it was an interesting way of portraying Kong. And they still did certain techniques like they did from the first movie, where they actually had to use mechanical hands to interact with Anne. So you had like the rear projection against the hand, but placed in a certain way, it looked like Kong was holding her and reacting to her in the exact same way. So, but Rick Baker did say that with more money and time, it could have been outstanding. But he said, unfortunately, it wasn't, and there was a compromise and forced deadlines. It was a once-in-a-life opportunity that was lost. And he really hated the idea that the fact that this Kong was more upright, not walking on all fours like a normal ape would. So he was really unhappy for that, and he was always been apologetic about what he had did. So, but I'll talk about him later on in the podcast, because he does come up again. Alright, so let's get into the story differences. Again, this is more going to be the bulk of this section as well as the next one. So, we have Andaro, who was brought on board by Carl Denham in the first movie. Dwan was discovered in a sail in a lifeboat, and Jack Prescott saw that ship, or saw that lifeboat in the distance, and she was brought on board. So instead of Denham looking for to make a big movie for his next project, we have Wilson looking for oil. So again, the oil was more of making it more relevant because of the energy crisis at that time. So if you are as old as I am, you would know what I'm talking about. Next, the camera that Denham used to do his filming was replaced by Jack Prescott, who served now as the ship's official photographer. So he used his camera in the exact same way. So, and the original Kong, he fought three different types of creatures. We saw the T-Rex, we saw the snake, and we saw pterodactyl. This one, he only fights one creature, which is an actual snake. That's about it. So, that was a big letdown for me. And the difference here, when Kong is captured, he gets knocked out by chloroform. So, he falls into a vat, or a big hole in the ground, filled with chloroform. Whereas Kong gets taken out by a gas bomb, and that was it. Just one, and he was done. There was no, you know, eighth wonder of the world comment. That line was never delivered in this movie. Although it is in a trailer, it is never said in this version. And as they were transporting Kong over in the oil tanker, Fred had asked if Jack and Dwan were going to be married because of their plan to put on the show, which is a reference that was said in the first movie, but it was actually during the actual show that it was revealed that when Jack came out, he was going to be the husband of Andaro, which was a surprise to me because that didn't come out of nowhere. But in this version, Fred saw there wasn't a connection between them, and he's like, you kids, you know, are you going to get married? That kind of thing. So he wanted to sell that whole wholesome marketing thing to the U.S. audience. Now, Kong is presented in Queens versus the original one being in Manhattan. Good thing about this version is that Wilson gets his just rewards, and he gets stepped on by Kong. And depending on the version you got to see, if you watched the one on TV, I think you got to see nothing left but a hat. His safari hat is left on the imprint on the ground, which means that Fred is on the bottom of Kong's foot, and he just, it's like, you know, he's stepped in something and just can't scrape it off. But in the movie version that I saw, he screams like, ah, I'm going to get stepped on, and then squish, and that's it. You don't see anything. Whereas Carl Denham, first movie, nothing happens to him. Damn you, Carl. The other big sequence that I found was interesting. Since they're in Queens, there was a train, and I think they were talking about this, this taking place in Astoria, Queens. So they escape on the L, and Kong, you know, knows Duan's scent, so the train is coming. Kong stops it, rips it open like a beer can, and tries to look for Duan. Whereas the first one, he does attack a train, but if I remember correctly, he has Anne in his hand. So it didn't make sense why he would be attacking a train out of nowhere. And I had asked my wife about that scene. She's like, well, it could be maybe he was, again, protecting her, like he did on the island, because he didn't know that that was a train. Like, he could have thought it was another animal. So, and of course, the biggest change, the obvious change, is that Kong goes to the World Trade Center, not the Empire State Building. So you do see it as Kong is climbing up the World Trade Center. In the background, you do see the Empire State Building. Now, that whole Tis Beauty that killed the Beast that Carl said, nothing. That never entered anyone's line of dialogue in this ending here. Duan is looking upon Kong, and a couple of moments before he dies, and then the crowd swarms her, and she yells out Jack, and she looks like she's about to go to him, and she's just surrounded by cameras, and the flash bulbs are going off, and she just, she doesn't go any further. She basically stays where she is and becomes that star that I mentioned earlier. She really wanted that attention like she's always wanted. So that was going to be her thing. Whereas Jack was like, you know, all along, I'm not that kind of flashy person that you want to be with. I'm not. But she kept kidding herself. But in reality, that's what she wanted. So she got her just dessert, so to speak. Now, aside from that, the only bone to pick is the fact that if you look at the picture or the movie poster, Kong is spread over the Twin Towers. 1 foot on one tower, the other foot on the other tower. He has Duan in one hand, and what looks to be like a jet or a blimp or some other vehicle crushed in the other, and then airplanes flying above. Airplanes. That doesn't happen. Kong fits on one just fine. He leaps between one and to the other. And there are no airplanes. So this original movie poster lied. Imagine a movie poster not giving you what you expected. I was disappointed. All right. So, let's get on to the movie, the music. John Barry. I love John Barry tremendously on this soundtrack. And honestly, this is one of these times in which the soundtrack is a much better product than the movie itself. It does what it has to do to really care and to get really invested and put you in a certain mood. I mean, it's really deep and gothic in the very beginning with, you know, that strong bass. But it doesn't really, it really kind of overpowers the movie. And I think the movie has its own problems. But in this case, the music is so well done. If you love John Barry, he's done a lot of the James Bond songs. My theme that I do for my sci-fi news, which is from the Black Hole soundtrack, it doesn't come any better. There are moments in which there's certain sequences, like when Duan is being prepped for Kong, and then the whole ritual is really going up in fervor, and Kong is coming, and that music is swelling, and it's just, wow, that is fantastic. But again, the majority of this film relies on that score really to kind of push you into feeling more than you really should. All right, so this ends this portion of the podcast. So I'm done with Kong 1976. I'm going to now play the trailer for the 2005 version and come back to you and talk about that. And then once that's all done, I'm going to give you my final verdict as to which Kong is going to reign supreme.
And lo, the beast looked upon the face of beauty, and beauty stayed his hand, and from that day forward, he was as one dead.
So you are ready for this voyage, Miss Darrow?
Sure.
Nervous?
Nervous? No. Should I be?
Imagine, if you will, an uncharted island. Thought to exist only in myth.
Wall! There's a wall ahead!
That's where I'll shoot my picture.
It's deserted.
Of course it's deserted. Place is a ruin.
They're taking Anne. Find her.
You saw something. What took her, Carl?
If you haven't found her in 24 hours, there'll be nothing left to find.
So that was the last trailer for King Kong, which we're now going to talk about, in which Peter Jackson is the director of King Kong. Now, for him, Peter Jackson has started basically his film career basically on King Kong. So he saw this movie when he was about 9 years old. So, and basically, at the age of 12, this is when he first started to attempt to create kind of his own version of King Kong. And, of course, eventually, he became the director of this movie that he wanted for such a long time. And he had also become the owner of the original armature of King Kong, one of two armatures that were the actual metal skeleton of King Kong that was used to animate in that movie. He actually owns it. So I thought that was kind of cool. Now, having said all this, a lot of the things that, because I just recently watched King Kong, was that it expands a lot more things that you saw in the original movie. Now, there are some things that go on way too long. In fact, a lot of the things went on way too long. But I think what sets apart his version is the relationship between Anne and Kong, just because of their emotional connection is by far probably more superior to anything that I've seen in the previous two movies. But because we know how things are going to end, the connection that Anne has with Kong watching the sunrise or the sunset on Skull Island, and then having that again on the Empire State Building, Kong responds about the word beautiful and he's tapping his chest like she did. So that was a very beautiful moment, and I could not have been more emotional about that, because that was something I wasn't expecting. But again, it added more to the movie that the other two movies just didn't have between Anne and Kong in that relationship. On a quick side note, I mentioned in the 1976 King Kong that I would bring back Rick Baker. Well, in the 2005 version, Peter Jackson and Rick Baker were in the plane that shot down Kong. So much like the first directors did, in which they killed Kong, Peter Jackson brought Rick Baker back to be in the plane to shoot down Kong. So I thought that was kind of cool. So let's move on to the actors. So in this version, except for the character of Jack Driscoll, everyone else is pretty much the same. So Naomi Watts plays Anne Darrow, again, same role that Faye Ray did. Jack Black is Carl Denham, again, Armstrong is the exact same version. Now, Adrian Brody does play Jack Driscoll, but his role is completely different. He is, a film writer or playwright. So it's a completely different version of the Jack Driscoll that we've seen in the previous movie, in which he was a sailor, basically. And the Jack Prescott is a professor / photographer. So, and King Kong, while it's not an 18-inch model, and it's not played by Rick Baker in a monkey suit or ape suit, this is actually going to be motion captured. And the person who this was based on was Andy Serkis, who played Lumpy, I believe, the cook that was on the ship. All right. So right off the bat, when we look at Anne Darrow, Naomi Watts gives a better, I'm not saying necessarily a better performance, but her role is definitely more fleshed out, more so than any other character, because it's really her resistance at the beginning towards Kong to her using her talents as a vaudeville performer to kind of put Kong in his place, because he was taken aback by that, but he actually started laughing, and she won him over, basically. So even though he was kind of possessive of her, he grew to be protective of her. Not so much because, you know, he owned her, but he actually became, you know, more than just friends. You know, he actually loved having those moments with her. So, and it does come through. And again, it's not so much a woman in peril. She actually seeks out Kong when he escapes, and she helps calm him down to the point where they're enjoying the last bits of freedom before the inevitable climbing of the Empire State Building, in which I think they're in Central Park and they're on a frozen pond, and Kong is basically ice skating. He's enjoying sliding around the ice, and it was just a beautiful moment, and it's very touching. So again, and embraces the fact that she has a special bond towards Kong. So, she's not running away. She is not as flighty as Duan is, but she's a little bit more well-rounded overall. Now, Jack Black as Carl Denham, in many respects, he is a lot like the Carl Denham from the first movie. He is looking to produce another movie. Whereas here, he's a lot like, even more than Fred Wilson. He is looking for a way out of certain situations. He's always looking to circumvent his circumstance. So, you know, everything from the investor is not liking his movies. He would steal the cans of film. And he was trying to get onto the ship without them having the possession of it. He kind of kidnapped Jack Driscoll, saying, I'll pay you, you know, $2,000 for your screenplay, but it was just more of a delay tactic. The ship's captain was also supposed to have been paid extra money just to leave the dock that much sooner. So it's a constant looking out for himself that he's able to look for opportunities without for him to be caught. So he's very much like he's very much like Fred Wilson in that respect, whereas Fred Wilson had that one moment to turn the feat of not having oil into using Kong as a promotion. Here, Carl is constantly doing that throughout the whole movie. Alright, so let's move on to Adrian Brody. As I mentioned, he plays Jack Driscoll. Now, he is supposed to be the love interest for Anne, and I think Anne is more enamored of the idea of Jack Driscoll, because in the very beginning, she has one of his playbills, so she knows his work and follows his career. And I'm not knocking Adrian Brody. He's a fine, talented actor. But there was nothing that I felt that was genuine. I didn't feel any kind of bond between the two of them. So, even though what I liked about this, there was another actor who portrayed the Jack Driscoll role while filming on the ship, and doing the exact same line. I thought that was kind of cool to see that happen. But I didn't really know what they were doing with this Jack Driscoll or what they were implying. But it was just a weird mix. I didn't see that role going any further, other than him kind of writing the story or writing the script along the way to the shoot on the island. Is this kind of like a take on what happened with Casablanca, in which every day there was a new set of pages to shoot and to film and going all along and shooting along the way? I don't know. I just don't understand why change that character. I mean, he does rise to the occasion. He goes after Anne, and there's no question that he is heroic at times. But it, again, doesn't really work at all. Even towards the end where he goes up to the Empire and gets Anne and kisses her, there's nothing. I'm sorry about that. All right. Now, let's go on to the last part, which is Andy Serkis's performance. So, as I mentioned, the 18 inches model versus the man in the ape suit. This is probably by far one of the best Kong that I've seen. And what works for this is because Andy Serkis' performance, especially when he look at his eyes. And again, Rick Baker did that very well with Kong in the 1976 version. But really, his eyes, his facial expressions, I think all of that is what helps Kong become more endearing. And the one moment that kind of was telling was that, you know, as Kong was playing around with Anne, and Anne started going into her vaudeville act, and he was laughing, and he was like, then he starts shoving her, and then she gets upset, and she says, no. He freaks out. You know, it's like the first time has ever heard this, and he doesn't know what to do, so he's in a rampage, and then he's throwing things around, and all of a sudden, a rock lands on him, and just kind of like, he can almost feel the embarrassment that and the shame that he felt, because he's, you know, he's never been stood up to like that. This little woman, you know, he's faced creatures and fought them, but this little thing stood up to him, and he just didn't know what to do. And that's where you see that moment that he's just like, I gotta leave. I gotta save face. So he just scatters off for a bit. So things like that. And of course, that again, the sunset moment, I think, is what is absolutely stunning. And it's a different version of Kong. He walks on all fours. He is more like a true gorilla. The mannerisms, everything about this is amazing. So I can't fault Andy whatsoever on this. Now, let's move on to the story aspect. And again, just talking about what had happened in this version of the other. So as I mentioned, Anne Darrow is really a vaudeville actor, as opposed to Anne in the first movie. Anne in the first movie just being some woman that Carl Denham just picks off the street because she just happens to look like the role or fits the clothing. And again, she's definitely more fleshed out as an actress. The other thing, that the capture of Anne from the ship, I kind of like the idea, because the whole shoreline is rocky, that the natives use these tall poles to vault over them, and that's how they captured her, because they were relatively close to the ship and used that as a way of getting her off the ship. And the other thing towards the end was that when Kong was on the stage, they started to perform a stage show in which it was referenced to the King Kong movie, in which we saw that ritual performance being done as sort of the white man's version of what the natives would have been. So there are a lot of little nods to all this that works so well. But again, the problem that hinders this whole movie is that it's over 3 hours long. So, and there are certain sequences that are just, again, hard to watch because it's creepy and it's uncomfortable. But I'll stop right here. So, let's move on to the music. James Howard Newton did the actual soundtrack to this movie. But what makes this more interesting is the fact that the previous composer is Howard Shore. Now, Howard Shore and Peter Jackson have worked previously together on the Lord of the Rings series. So, if you hear his music, it's very epic. It's beautifully scored. The problem lies is that due to creative differences between the two of them, Howard Shore left the project. So James was brought in, and within a month, he had to come up with a new score and work in actually some of Howard's earlier score moments. So what works best is that the quieter moments between Anne and Kong, like the sunset moments, those are the moments that score is beautiful. It exemplifies that relationship as best as possible. The problem lies is that when you hear Kong's theme or you hear a big action sequence, it does get lost. because there's so much going on, because there's the action just goes on almost longer than expected, that music cannot catch up. And I've listened to the cues that I know in my head versus the visuals on the screen, and I'm like, you cannot hear it. You cannot hear it. So it's a shame because it's a good score, but again, the visuals just really outplay the actual music. So unlike John Barry, in which the visuals were very meh, that score was overpowering, whereas Max's score was probably the best in complementing what you saw on the screen, and then matching that emotionally with the music. So, not a bad score, but again, when you compare, and that's the whole idea of verses, when you compare it to each other, you actually see there is quite a difference. So, this ends finally this portion of my King Kong verses. So, I am now going to be talking about the final grade. Which movie will reign supreme? Alright, well, we finally are here at the final moments to reveal which movie reigns supreme. Before I finish up, let's talk about some Kong time, in which how much screen time did King Kong have for each movie? Let's start off with the first one, 1933 version. The movie ran for 105 minutes, and Kong was on the screen for 37 minutes, which comes down to about 35%. Next, the 1976 version of King Kong ran for 134 minutes, with a King Kong time of 47 minutes, so also coming down to 35% of the movie. Lastly, the 2005 version of King Kong, which ran for 187 minutes. While King Kong was on the screen for about 61 minutes, it still only came down to 33% of the movie. So, in perspective, really the first and second one, relative to the running time, had a couple extra percentages here as far as screen time. So, the question is now, what do I rate these movies? Well, Kong, 1933, I give the director or directors an A, the actors a B, the story an A, the music an A. The 1976 version, I give that a C, the actors a B, the story a B, and the music an A. 2005 version, I give the director a B, actors B plus, and B minus for the story, and the music is going to be a B. So, hands down, you know what the win is going to be, right? Do I even have to say it? Do I? Fry? The winner is King Kong 1933 version. So that ends my podcast for this Versus. Thank you for listening to the Monster Sci-Fi Show presenting Versus.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.